record what I'm saying, and if it works, I will put it up on the web. It might be that it comes out horrible and one can't understand anything. And then I'll need to think about a different way of doing it. Okay, so what we did is we defined cosets of an ideal. These were equivalence classes. These were equivalence classes for the relation that little a is equivalent to b if and only if a minus b is contained in the ideal. And then we have seen that every coset has the form a plus little a. And what does this mean? This is a set of all sums r plus a, where little r lies in the ideal. And in the example, we've seen this in examples, and one other way of looking at it, saying the integers, if you take the integers and your ideal consists of all the even integers, there is one other coset, namely the odd integers. And if you take an ideal there, which is, say, the multiples of 3, your coset somehow correspond to, well, it's not any longer even and odd, but if you look at 3, you get not just two classes, but you get something like a 3, even the multiples of 3, and then you get two 3 odds, namely the ones where you have remainder 1 and the ones where you have remainder 2. And that forms the coset. Okay. And what I now want to do, I want to do arithmetic on the coset. So what I want to do is I want to define a sum. I want to say a plus little a plus little b, and I want to define this to be basically the coset where I just add the representatives a plus b. And when I do this, I need to be a bit careful with such a definition. Namely, what I'm doing, these cosets are sets of elements. And I describe them with these representatives A and B. But I could have chosen other representatives. So what I need to do is I need to show that this makes sense, that if I choose different representatives, that the result is still the same. For an example where something could, where this works or where it could go wrong, suppose again you take an equivalent, if you take equivalence class, suppose you take t people and you take an equivalence class is given by first name of the person. And now you would say you want to determine a salary based on the representative. That certainly doesn't make sense. You will have different people with the same first name who have very different salaries. So it doesn't make sense to say you take your equivalence class of you determine a salary by taking one person out. Okay. On the other hand, if you take, would say, you want to determine the gender of a person by taking, by looking at the first name, well, now it depends a little bit on the culture in which you are. Here in America, one actually has to be a little bit careful because with some names like Tracy, it's not always clear what the gender is. But general, one that would make more sense. Or if you ask, or you could say from the first name, you could determine what culture did the parents like, or so from where they picked the name. So some things I can determine from a representative. It doesn't matter which representative I pick. Other things not. And the same thing here. I have to be careful here. Testing this is called checking that this is well defined. And well defined simply means though we make a definition based on representatives, we use the representatives A and B here, regardless how the representatives chosen, the result is always the same. So this is what we call the test that this is well defined. Okay, so how do we test this? We need to test that if I choose different representatives, I still get the same result, right? So I choose different representatives, so assume a plus little a is the same as a plus little c, and similarly a plus little b is the same as a plus little d. So c and d are different representatives for the same cosine, right? And now I want to show that if I would add instead with representatives c and d, I would get the same result as if I had added with representatives a and b. Right? That's what I need to show. So I need to show that a plus b is the same as a plus c plus b. Okay. So that's what I can assume, these two things. This is what I have to show. Now, how do I show this? Well, somewhere I need to use the definition of what the cosets actually are, or what equality means. Well, if a plus a is the same as a plus c, this means that a minus c is contained in the ideal a, right? Similarly, this means here that b minus b is contained in the ideal a. And what I now need to do is I just need to look at the difference here, right, to show this. So what I do is I consider a plus b minus c plus d. Okay, and I will write this by splitting it up here. I will write this as a minus c plus b minus d. And I do this because these are expressions which I know already. Okay. A minus C, I know, is contained in A. That was my first assumption. B minus D is also contained in A. This is my second assumption. Right? So I have the sum of two elements in A. This is clearly contained in A because ideals are closed under addition. Right? So I have seen that the difference of A plus B by C plus D is in A. So by the definition of cosets, I can conclude that a plus b is the same as a plus c plus d. So even if I would have chosen different representatives for the same cosets, the sum as given here on the representatives is the same. Whether I represent it with a plus b or whether I represent it with c plus d, as a coset it is actually the same. The representative is different, but as a coset it is the same. Let me show you this concretely, what this means concretely in an example. Let's suppose my ring is the integer. Let's suppose my ideal is the multiples of 5. And now I pick cosets, let's say little a is equal to 1 and little b is equal to 3. Okay. So I want to look at a plus 1 plus the other coset is a plus 3, and by my definition, what should it be by the definition? It said just add the elements, so it claims it should be a plus 4. Right? Now, what would happen if I choose different representatives for the same coset? So let's suppose I choose c is equal to 16 and d is equal to a, right? Then I have that a plus little a is the same as a plus c. 16 and 1 are in the same coset, because they have the same remainder when doing division modulo. Similarly, I have that coset, the result is the same. And that's just what I've proven generally here. So it makes sense to do this addition defining using only the representatives. It does not go wrong. If someone else would choose different representatives as a coset, they would get the same result. They might get a different representative, but as a coset, they get the same result. Okay, that's addition. Now I want to do the same thing also for multiplication.
So, quick question.
Yeah?
Friday you talked about the new addition.
Yes.
Is that what this plus 24 versus plus 4 is? I wasn't quite clear what you meant by it. You're doing a new type of addition.
It's the addition of, it's this addition here, the addition of the coset. Right? So before we couldn't add cosets. Now I say we add cosets. Namely, I add a plus 16 and I add a plus 8 and I say the result is the coset. For example, a plus 4. Or a plus 24, which is the same coset. Okay. So now for multiplication. So I define the product of the coset with a coset A plus B. I just define this product to be the coset where I take the product of the representatives A times B. Okay. So, in the example, if I take A plus 1 times A plus 3, this shall be A plus 1 times which is A plus 3, right? Let's also, just since I'm working in the example, what happens with different representatives? If I take different representatives, if I take A plus 16 times A plus 8, what do I get there? I get A plus 16 times 8. 16 times 8 is 128. So I get A plus 128. And A plus 128 happens to be the same as A plus 3, right? Because that's the remainder when doing division modulo 5. 128 minus 3 is 125, the multiple of 5. So, indeed, these are the same, and I get the same result. So, in this example, it seems, again, that the multiplication seems to work out. But that's just an example. I need to prove it in general. So, now show that this is well defined. Multiplication. Right, and I do it exactly in the same way. So assume that A plus A is the same as A plus C. And A plus B is the same as A plus B. And now have to show A plus AB is the same as A plus CD. Right? So it's exactly the same as here. I've just replaced the addition here in these two places by a multiplication because I now want to show that multiplication is well defined. Note, this plus is the plus from the coset. This plus always stays a plus because that's what describes the coset. That says the equivalence class with this representative. Okay, so that's what I have to show. Right. So I need to consider the difference of the representatives. I need to look at AB minus CD. I want to show that AB minus CD, that this lies in the idea. Right? Okay. What do I know what lies in the ideal? I know that A minus C lies in the ideal and B minus C lies in the ideal. So, what I'm going to do is, therefore, I'm going to add and subtract some terms which will let me write this nicer in the form of a product. So I have AB here. Because I want to consider A minus C, what I will do is I will subtract minus CD here. Well, I can't just change it, so I need to add it. Plus CD here. I need to add it again to make up for it, and I have minus CD here. Okay. And now I will write this as a product. I will combine these, I will take a factor B out of here, and I will take a factor C out of here. So this is A minus C times B plus C times B minus C. Okay, and the one trick is here to inserting and subtracting this term and adding it again, which doesn't change the expression. Okay. So now what do I know? I know that A minus C is contained in the ideal. Similarly, B minus C is contained in the ideal. That was my assumption here, right? A is the same as A plus C, so A minus C lies in the ideal. So A minus C lies in the ideal. Okay. And now I'm using the special property of an ideal. In some way, that is the reason why we consider this special property. Okay. Because it is an ideal, I know that if this is an A, also this times B is an A. Right? That's the special ideal property. If I multiply, it stays in there. Similarly here, this is an A. Because this is an A, if I multiply with an arbitrary element in the ring, and this other element does not have to lie in the ideal, I'm still, my product stays in the ideal. No, 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 they are not in the ideal. They are arbitrary ring elements. We just know that A minus C is in the ideal, right? If you look here at the example, my ideal is multiples of 5. 1 and 3 are not multiples of 5. They are not in the ideal. The only thing which I know is that 16 minus 1 is a multiple of 5, and 8 minus 3 is a multiple of 5. Right? Otherwise, they're arbitrary elements. So this is the place where I really need this extra ideal property, that if I multiply with arbitrary ring elements, I stay in there. And one can do the proof, one can actually show basically from here that this condition will be necessary to make multiplication behave okay. If you don't have the property, if you would try to do the same thing for a subring, the multiplication thing would go wrong. You wouldn't have a sensibly defined multiplication. Well, but so everything is an A, so the sum is in A, and therefore I know that A plus AB is the same as A plus CD. Okay, so I can multiply and I can add cosine. And in both cases, my arithmetic makes sense. It is really an operation on the sets. It does not depend on the choice of my representative. Okay. So now I have if I have a ring and I have an ideal, I can take all the cosets, the collection of cosets, and on this collection of cosets, I have an addition and a multiplication. And whenever I have a set, and this is if you want, a binary operation on the collection of cosets, because the sum of two cosets is again a coset, and the product of two cosets is again a coset. So what we now have is if A is an ideal in R, the addition and multiplication defined this way are binary operations on the collection of cosets. And I'm calling it the collection simply. I could have said on the set of cosets, but coset has set in the name, and then it's just slightly awkward in the description. So that's just why I say on the collection of cosets. If you want, you can write, call it the set of cosets. Okay, so now we have this, we have the cosets, and we have a binary operation. Actually, two binary operations, addition and multiplication. And now we can go back to basic, almost the start of this course, and we can ask, okay, we have these operations. Does it form a ring? And indeed, that's what I claim. I claim it will form a ring. And that's the next theorem. So, theorem. If A in R, the coset of A form a ring under the operation as just defined, this ring is called the quotient ring. Quotient ring of R by A, and is denoted by R quotient A. And what is this as a set? It's simply all the cosets. So it's the coset A plus R, where R lies in the ring. So it's all these cosets, but considered as a ring, so together with addition and multiplication of cosets, as we just defined. So that's the quotient ring. Okay. So before proving this, if we take again our example, if our ring is the integers, if the ideal is the multiples of 5, what is the quotient ring? Well, the quotient ring consists of the cosets. What are the cosets here? They are a plus 0, a plus 1, a plus 2, a plus 3, and a plus 4. Right? Because these are the five cosets of this ideal. And what is my operation on the cosets? Well, I add the representatives, and then I can say I could reduce the result modulo the ideal. So I could reduce the result modulo 5. So this is basically the same as the integers modulo 5. Okay, it's not exactly the same. When we define the integers modulo 5, I said we define it as the numbers 0 to 4 with a different operation. Some people actually define Z5 as the set of these cosets, as this quotient ring. For us, since we define define it differently, well, we would have to say it's an isomorphic ring. But I think it's pretty clear that what the isomorphism is and that they really are essentially the same structure. So that's the generalization of modulo, which I mentioned by now many, many times. If we have a ring and an ideal, we can form the quotient ring. And that basically means working modulo the ideal. And that is something we can do in any ring with any ideal. And the modulo arithmetic, which we've seen so far, working modulo a number or working modulo a polynomial, is just a special case. And in the examples where I said, let's work modulo a number and modulo a polynomial, well, none of you, in some way you could have asked at this point, does this make sense? Could things go wrong? Or could, what would happen if I first reduce modulo the number and then modulo the polynomial or vice versa? Well, things will go well there. Actually, the proper way of defining it is just to say, well, if you want to work modulo the number and modulo the polynomial, you take the ideal generated by the number and the polynomial. That's why we did ideals generated by elements. And we work modulo this ideal. And I'll show you later examples of many more examples of this. So that's why this makes sense. But that's the reason for this. We have this new structure. This is probably the most important definition in the whole course, this quotient structure. And why is it important? Well, on the one hand, it is more complicated when you use that again, a ring. But the reason for doing this, why do people bother with it? It's not that we say, oh, well, great, rings, I can't get enough from rings, I want even more. Here I have another ring. That's not the reason for it. But the reason is basically you don't want to have the rings just like stamps or butterflies to put them in an album, but you want the rings to do certain things. So you often want to have rings with particular properties. And then you can ask, how can you build such a ring? Yes, you could try out. You could try to work with multiplication an addition table and try to hope that you end up with something which is a ring, but that would be a horrible mess to do. What you can do instead, and that's indeed what is often done, is to say, let's take some big ring which, well, doesn't have all the properties I want, but at least some of them. So you start with something like the integers or with polynomials or so, and they are somehow too much. So what you do is you take a suitable ideal and you say the structure in which you work is the quotient ring. And then because of this theorem, you know immediately that thing which you've constructed that way is a ring. You will not have to prove all the boring ring axioms one by one. You will know, because this is always a ring, that you will end up with a ring. And we will see certain properties, certain things which one can do, or which one can, if the ideal has certain properties, that the quotient ring will have certain properties. And the examples which we have done, where I said let's work modulo a polynomial and modulo a number, and when we did this modulo construction, which was basically taking a quotient ring, we ended up with a field. Well, fields are very nice structures. We will see applications in a little while where one really so that's a generic way how one can construct certain fields with finitely many elements. And it's a very convenient way of doing so, convenient in two senses. First, you can construct a large class of such objects in the same way. And secondly, compared to someone writing down addition and multiplication table, testing the axioms for a ring is really easy. Well, we don't need to test anything. We just refer to this theorem. Right? When I gave you this field with four elements. I said, well, and it is a ring and it is a field. You can verify the thing. But I also mentioned verifying it at that point is actually rather nasty, because if you work with a multiplication table, the only way how you can test associativity is to look at all possible triples of elements. Well, if you have a field with, even not very big, let's say you have a field with 9 elements, then looking at all the possible triples, you have 9 times 9 times 9, that's 243 elements. 243 such triples you need to test. That certainly isn't fun. And then 9 is not a big number. On the other hand, once you can refer to this theorem, you just will know it automatically is a ring. Okay, so that's the reason for this construction. This is really, in some way, these quotient structures are algebra or mathematics, general tricks for building bespoke objects with particular properties. Here we're doing it for rings, and we will see that one can do it also with other structures. And in some way, that is a big reason why this course exists at all. Unfortunately, in other courses, one typically, as an undergraduate, doesn't get very far towards using this construction. But let me just give you one small example where you basically want to do something like such a construction. Namely, if you think about the real numbers. Well, you all were told in somewhere in middle school or high school there are these things called the real numbers. And, I mean, how were they defined at this point? Probably something, they are the points on this line. But are they really the points on this line? I mean, someone, of course, they rely at this point that you don't yet know about physics and quantum mechanics. Someone, physicist might say, look, but the points there aren't just finitely many. Quantum mechanics tells us there are the atoms and everything, and at some point you can't put another, there isn't another one in between. But that's not what you want. You want really infinitely many. Okay, so that's not such a good definition. So let's say we look at numbers with a decimal point, right? Real numbers are numbers written in the form decimal point, and they might go on infinitely long after the decimal point. Okay, very good. But then one thing happens, and sometimes you encounter this in school, and typically this is rather disconcerting to students. Namely, if you take 0.9999999999, that is the same as 1. Right? And you might have seen. And the reason that it is the same as 1 is if you take 0.9999999999, you can see, for example, if you add something to it, you always basically get a carry from some decimal position beyond what you actually wrote down on the board, and therefore you get the same. Or you could write it down as an infinite sum, and then you use the formula for the sum of the geometric series. So, what is happening there? Why is 0.999999 the same as 1? The reason is basically that the real numbers actually are not infinitely long decimal numbers. The infinitely long decimal numbers are something like this ring R. And then you quotient something out. And what you quotient out is basically infinitely long such infinitely long expressions which in the end give you the same result. So you put, for example, if you look at these decimal fractions, if you would look at them as sequences, your sequence representing 1.000 minus the sequence representing 0.99999. Or vice versa. So this is some sequence, and you take the difference difference there. That would be something in this ideal. And the real numbers really are such equivalence classes. And if you want to construct them, I mean, you want the real numbers in the end, you want them to be a field. So if you would try to construct them in another way, you might potentially really struggle to show that they are a field. If you do this kind of process, and I haven't told you all the details of how to do it, that gets rather messy and needs a lot of analysis to do. But if one uses this idea to take something bigger, named which one can easily describe, namely infinitely long decimal expansions, they are not yet the things you want. And then you quotient out where you want things to be the same. And when you work with them, of course, you just work with the representatives. That's the same what we're doing here. How I did the addition, I just said, we do it with the representatives. And that's how you typically work with decimal fractions. And very rarely you see these weird things, like 1 is the same as 0.999999999. That's just a small glimpse and basically calculus and analysis up to, probably even up to including the third year or so, basically skip a bit about it. They say they are the real numbers. We believe they are there. They have certain properties. They don't show you how they arise. But that's really the way how they arise. And this quotienting out is making things easy. Okay, so that's an example of a reason why this quotient construction is really important. Okay. So what we now want to do is we need to show this is a ring. Okay. This looks initially probably rather daunting. Oh my God, now I have these weird new things. Then I want to show that it's a ring. So I need to go through all of these properties. But as you will see, in a moment. Actually, once we know that the addition and the multiplication are well defined, showing that it is a ring is one of the most boring exercises you can imagine. Because you can just always go almost immediately and use the fact that R is a ring, and all your properties will basically fall in your lap. Okay. So, let's prove the associativity of addition. So what I need to do is I need to take three elements and I need to add them, right? So I take a plus a and I add to it a plus b, and then I'll add afterwards to it a plus c. What is this? By definition, first, this sum, what is the sum of these two cosets? Definition of addition of cosets is a plus b. And now I add to it a plus c. What is this? By definition of addition, a plus, so I need to add c to a plus b, right? So here, and here I've just used the way how I defined the addition of cosets. Okay. But now this is an addition in the ring R, and R is a ring, right? Because R is a ring, addition in R is associative. So this is clearly the same as a plus b plus c. And here I use that addition in R is associative, because R is a ring. So I can do this there. Okay. And now I just basically walk back the same way. I split up this addition again. So this is a plus a plus a plus b plus c. And that is the same as a plus a plus b plus a plus c. Right? And these steps here are just almost the same as these steps, just in reverse. And if you look at it, I really haven't done, I mean, what have I done? I've did I do, well, I used the definition of addition of cosets. Okay, that wasn't very hard. And I once used that the ring R is associative. But I really didn't have to do any work here. It almost followed automatically. Right? And all the other properties follow basically along the same line. So commutativity of addition. Well, I have A plus commutative. What I do is I look at A plus A and I add A plus B by definition of addition of cosets. This is A plus B, which is because R is a ring. A plus B plus A, addition in R is commutative, and now I can just take my representatives and can do the addition here, and that is of course A plus B plus A by the definition of how I add cosets. So I have seen addition in the quotient structure is commutative. And again, some writing effort. But part as a handwriting exercise, there is nothing behind it. Associativity of multiplication, you could almost verbatim copy this. You just need to replace addition by multiplication. It goes through exactly the same way. And then you use associativity of multiplication here. So the only things which are slightly interesting, oh, and distributivity also. At least it's basically a distributivity as an exercise, goes along the same line. The only two things which are slightly interesting are existence of the zero and existence of additive inverses. Right? So what is the zero? I claim that is the coset A plus zero. Well, not very inventive to pick this one. Why is it the zero? Well, if I take A plus A and I add A plus zero, I get A plus zero. And because zero is the zero in the ring R, this is A plus A. What is the additive inverse? If I want the negative of A plus A, I claim this is A plus the additive inverse of little a in the ring. Why is this the case? Let's just see if I add this to A plus A. If I take A plus A and I add to it A plus minus A, what do I get? By definition, I get A plus A minus A, and that is A plus zero, which is the zero element of the ring. So therefore, this must be the additive inverse of this. Okay, and the rest I leave to you as an exercise for itself. So that proves this theorem, and this is really the well-defined, the only hard part there. The rest of the theorem is basically trivial to prove. It's just a writing exercise. The quotient structure, therefore, is a ring. And these quotient rings, again, are used in mathematics to construct structures with particular properties. So, of course, one question is, how can I get particular properties for this quotient ring? How can I make the quotient ring, for example, a ring with 1? How can I make the quotient ring commutative? How can I make the quotient ring an integral domain? So not having zero divisors. How can I describe the fact that the quotient ring has zero divisors? How can I make the quotient ring a field? And these are things I want to study next. Yeah, but not today, since we are out of time. Thank you very much.